Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Although I actually don't consider it an intruder if the guest already has their own cushion here in Madame Perry's salon, their own place to sit, and even come with their own snacks sometimes. So that is not an intruder. Hey, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Madame Perry Salon. I am your host and cruise director, Madame Perry. Oh, you can call me Jennifer Perry. I want to say, first of all, again, we've had some fantastic, this whole year has been fantastic on the show, and I've got so many more subscribers and listeners and great guests, and on a lot of shows, had some very nice sponsors, and it's all thanks to you for listening, subscribing, downloading, and telling your friends about it, and that helps me to get more exceptional guests like I have to coming up tonight. But first, let me go over a few things recently. I've got some specials for you coming up. You know, a couple of weeks ago on the show, my guest was David Fischoff, and many of you know David Fischoff is like Uber sports and entertainment agent. He's the guy that came up with the concept of the Ringo Starr All-Star Band and pitched it to Ringo. You know, he went ahead and made a whole commercial about it, had it done in a studio, and then pitched it to Ringo with that, saying, see, wouldn't this be cool to hear? And also he created the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp. So this, which is where my point, and yes, I had one, lies here, and that is David Fischoff wanted me to remind you that in September, the next edition of Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, you know, that's where you go and there's a main featured band and then several other celebrity musicians who are there to coach you or counsel you. And they help you. They help you develop your technique. You work up some songs, and then you do a live show in a club or a venue like House of Blues or Whiskey a Go-Go, someplace like that. In September, it's the Judas Priest edition. But some of the counselors were, well, like Rudy Sarzo from Quiet Riot and Ozzy. I think he's on tour now with Guess Who. But he, you know, he's a bass player. He was on our show back in September. His brother Robert Sarzo. And I forget all the other people who are counselors, plus the people in Judas, the guys in Judas Priest. But if you sign, if you register and attend September's edition of Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp, the Judas Priest edition, and you tell them that Madame Perry sent you, or you heard about it on Madame Perry Salon, David Fischoff himself will give you a guitar worth $700. He did not divulge the names of the guitars. He may have different brands, I'm sure, with whom he works. However, just say, sign up for it, and you get there. And if you told them when you were registered that you that Madame Perry sent you, you will get a free guitar valued at $750, somewhere in that range, he said. So don't let that kind of deal pass you by. And let's see, what else? Coming soon, we have Lita Ford, who's quite the shredder. She was the queen of metal, one of the first shredders, and she's also worked on that. Also, Kat Kanofis, who you might have seen on Dr. Oz, talking about one of her books, Surviving Cancerland. That's the book that she gave me when I first met her a few years back in New York at Book Expo. But she's got a new book coming out on dreams and diagnosis, and she'll even analyze your dreams right here. But tonight is a guest that we were lucky to have back in. By the way, you can always call in and talk to the guest, and the number to call in, toll-free in the continental U.S., is 646-716-9999. 1-800-522-2222. And actually, I've already got people on hold waiting for tonight's guest. That's how cool this person is. This is his second book this year. He's a true crime journalist, TV personality, extremely prolific true crime author. And I have to say, he is my favorite male true crime author. Actually, he is my favorite now, completely. And he's also going to be on a new TV show on a new channel, the Escape Network, called Deep Undercover, about the high-stakes world of undercover operations by the police and the FBI. So please welcome once again to Madame Perry's Salon, Michael Fleeman. Michael, come in. Get comfortable.
Thank you so much for having me.
I am thrilled to have you here. Just happy to have you back this year. I used to have two books. You know, I always say the thing with like my top three favorite true crime writers, I tell them they don't write fast enough for me. And yet you just really came through for the fans and put out two this year. That's love for your fans,
thanks.
Michael.
It's been great. These are two wonderful stories. And, I kind of base my books on the stories and if they're good enough and detailed enough and compelling enough. And these two came along, you know, bang, bang, and so I was able to do two books.
Well, I remember when you were on, I think it was back in January, February, we were discussing your book, Crazy for You, and that was about the Rusty Snyderman murder case that happened right here in Atlanta, Georgia.
And that was Andrea Snyderman. She was convicted of
Andrea Snyderman
perjury, obstruction of justice in her husband's murder, and many people thought she should have been convicted of murder. But she's now out. She served her time and is a free woman.
Yeah, and then of course her lover Hemi Newman was convicted of the murder of Rusty. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Guess he's still
twice.
In the big house?
Sorry?
Twice, yeah. Still in the big house?
Yeah.
Where he will be?
He had two trials. Yeah, two times he struck out. And, you know, he was the lover, alleged lover, Andrea Snyderman, still denies that they had a relationship, despite a lot of evidence to the contrary. And of course, the case, the allegation was that she seduced him to fatally shoot her husband to get him out of the way and to get a lot of insurance money. And Hemi Newman, who was her boss, was convicted of murder, and she was not. And he had pleaded insanity and said that visions and spirits had driven him. He's an undiagnosed bipolar. And the court rejected the insanity defense, which is a very, very hard one to pull off.
Which I believe I told you that in this case, although I might normally look, you know, kind of look a little funny at that, the insanity defense. However, I told you, and since you were here, you know from whence I speak, that anyone who could commit a crime of this nature in daylight in Atlanta, Georgia, in a public place, you know, a place with a lot of witnesses around, potential witnesses, and things that they can escape during morning rush hour traffic in Atlanta, I would think that would be a shoe-in for an insanity defense, because you can't even get to work on time, much less try to escape from a crime scene. So, yeah.
Well, it was the traffic, actually.
Criteria.
He was able to disappear. What do you call it? The circle? What is the highway
perimeter,
that goes around
perimeter.
Atlanta? The perimeter,
yeah,
thank you.
The perimeter.
And he sort of got lost in the perimeter amid all that traffic, and it helped him. You know, it wasn't just a public place. He shot this man in the parking lot of a preschool with a bunch of children around.
Yeah. Which is horrible enough. But now your new book, your hot new book, The Black Widower. Tell us what this is about.
Well, this is the story of Harold and Tony Henthorne. They're a married couple. They have a little girl. They lived in Denver. And on their wedding anniversary, they had a very romantic weekend away. They went to the Stanley Hotel, which, if anybody has read or seen The Shining, that's the hotel in The Shining. It's a stately, old, very expensive place now to stay, and they spent the night there. And the next morning, they scheduled a hike, and he had made reservations at a steakhouse for later. They had a babysitter watching their kid back in Denver, and they took this hike up to a point that oversees all of Estes Park, a spectacular fall day. And they get to the ledge, and according to Harold, he gets a text from the babysitter informing them about their daughter's soccer game that they had won. And he's reading this text, and he looks up, and he sees a blur, and Tony, his wife, slips off the cliff, 50, 100-foot fall, and crashes down, to the bottom. And he makes his way down to the bottom, and he finds her there very, very injured, as you might imagine. And he calls from his cell phone 911. And the book begins with his distress call to 911, pleading for help, saying that his wife is gravely injured from this fall, and he needs some help. And what transpires is the investigation showing that things are not as they seem. And the question becomes very quickly, did she really fall, or did Harold push her?
All right. So there, and there's the whole thing. And then, let's see, so because he came into a lot of money with life insurance.
Yes, Tony, his wife, she was a doctor, an ophthalmologist, and she was insured, helped. $4.5 million he inherited, he was able to get.
All right, to start with, since we already have someone calling on the line, I don't want to keep them waiting any longer, because I know how I'm certainly looking forward to talking with you. So let me just click in. Hello, welcome to Madame Perry Salon. You're here with me and Michael Fleeman. And what is your name, please?
Hi, Jennifer. This is Robert Taylor.
Robert Taylor, hi.
Yeah.
Good
to
hear from you.
I had a question for
writers.
Michael.
Okay.
Okay. Michael, I noticed that you deal primarily in high profile crimes. And I was wondering about how you gather information. Do you have any inside tips from law enforcement that the general public isn't privy to? And do you have a good rapport with law enforcement, and do you have certain individuals that you rely on to give you some of these inside tips and information?
Yeah, I've been writing these books for 15 years. I've done about 11 or 12 books. And at each book, I usually work pretty closely with somebody on the law enforcement, or somebody's on the law enforcement side, whether it's the detectives on the case or the prosecutors, but almost always somebody. And it depends on at what stage the case is. For instance, in this book, the trial was still going on when I was writing it, so the federal prosecutors would not talk to me, and they're very reticent to speak. It's hard to get federal people. But I did talk to a coroner in this case who was involved in the case, and which is, on the law enforcement side. I neither idolize them nor demonize them. I look at them as people who are part of the story, professionals who are working towards solving the case. In this book, there was some very, very good police work involved, and then there was some very, very, when you talk about later, some very, very bad police work. I don't really come to any judgments. I just try to lay out how it is. But over the years, I've developed a lot of respect for law enforcement, especially when you get to the level of detective. in cases like this, you have to be really, really good. You're juggling a lot of different things, and I have really the highest respect for the folks who are working on these cases. And like you said, they're often high profile, which means, you know, they're doing their work in the public eye. You know, I get up in the morning and I write for a couple mm-hmm. hours. No one sees me work, you know. But these folks now are out in the field. They're collecting evidence. They're doing witness interviews. You know, people can almost watch them in real time. And so the work has gotten even harder. My first book was called If I Die. It was a case in Las Vegas. And Phil Ramos was the lead detective there. He's since retired. We're Facebook friends, and we keep in touch over the years. So in terms of inside information, for everybody, I mean, you know, with journalism, I often do go off the record with people to kind of help
right.
guide me. I don't want, you know, sometimes they would, look, I can't tell you this officially because, you know, certain ethical constraints or whatever, but if you write that, you'll be wrong, or maybe you might want to go in this direction, or they'll help me find documents, that sort of thing. You know, it's never as sexy as, oh, they're going to, you know, reveal to me some amazing inside information, but you know,
right.
I try to work, and my approach is always, look, let's tell this as truthfully and as fairly and as completely as possible, and help me anyway in that regard. And so that's usually the relationship I have.
Well, I love the ID channel. I'm a big fan, and I would love to see if I can get access to the Escape Network. I don't know if I can get it in my area or not, but I'm going to look into it. It sounds like a very interesting show.
Yeah, it's a new
undercover
channel. I actually barely get it here in Los Angeles. Or you can go on Netflix. I just did a documentary about Robert Kardashian.
Okay.
You go on Netflix. That one's on Netflix right now.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
Hey,
well, thank you very much.
I see you on TV a lot. I saw it. Okay. Hey, Robert Taylor, thank you for calling in.
Oh, you're quite welcome. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Goodbye. Yeah, Robert's one of our. He's like family here. He's one of our favorite callers.
Oh, it was a good question.
He's an author at and yeah, he's a pretty savvy guy. So thanks. So anyway, yeah, you know my. Like I told you, my first husband was a homicide detective, and we met working at the police station. So, yeah, you're exactly right. I'm so glad you brought that up because they do. They work in the public eye under a lot of pressure, and I know what it's like to get those phone calls, you know, and during the night, you know, to get up, to go to get dressed, go to a crime scene. Because he always had his clothes set out the night before so that no matter when he got the call, everything would be ready to go if he were called during the night. And then also, of course, everything you do, people are watching you and trying to second guess you and question, but just so many things you can't, you know, tell people you're on to or what you're chasing down. But you do have to be very thorough and very fair. Okay, I have another call here, Michael.
Okay.
And she's coming here inside Madame Perry's salon with us. This is the host of Everything Relationships. And my BFF, Kenya Colbert. Kenya, come on in and talk to Michael.
Hello, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. How are you?
I am well. I'm enjoying the interview. I just had to jump in and just kind of sit in and grab me a cushion next to you guys. So I can get more closer details, better details.
Yeah, so we were just getting started, Kenya, about the book. Because, you know, I think I told you when I got this book, I think I had it all read in about 36 hours. Because, you know, I have to stop now and then and cook dinner for my husband and walk the dogs. But
or sleep.
I read this in no time. Or sleep. Yes, sleep sometimes. So Michael just explained, you know, the story opens with the woman, Toni Hinthorn.
Yeah.
And, you know, she and her husband are on this trip. It's supposed to be a romantic anniversary trip, I believe, or just a little romantic trip, and he looks up, you know, they're hiking on this mountain, he gets a phone call, looks up, and she's gone, And that's when he calls for help. So, get us back in the story, Michael.
Well, the first suspicions actually come while he's on the phone calling 911. And, you know, he gives the initial information, and my wife has fallen, and she's badly hurt. But his tone is odd to the dispatchers. He almost seems put out that they're not helping him fast enough. He's irritated. He at one point insists on getting a rescue helicopter, which, you know, they're not going to do. It's on the side of a cliff. It's a very dangerous maneuver. That's just not how it works. And he's angry that they won't send a helicopter. And he's arrogant. He says, "Look, I'll pay for it," which is an odd thing to say when your wife, you know, is lying there dying. And then, most suspicious of all, they say, "Have you done any CPR?" And he's like, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, let's put you on with another dispatcher who's an expert in CPR, and she'll walk you through it." And they patch him in, and she starts telling him how to do the chest compressions and the air. And he's like, "Yeah, I did, don't worry about it." And he just didn't seem to want to revive his wife. He's just, when are you going to get here? So from the very beginning, he's acting odd. And that's what sort of set the tone for the investigation that would follow.
Okay, so, yeah, so just his attitude. And, you know, you can say, some people will say, well, you know, we all respond to a situation and, you know, we have different ways. But something like that, I think you would certainly show a lot more emotion, not impatience with the people. But you would be, you know, "Yes, I'm doing this now. I've done the compressions. I've done so and so." You would be on it more. There would be a different kind of emotion altogether. So they don't get taken. They don't get help right away. He had to stay there several hours, didn't he, or overnight?
Yes, because you know they did was, this is a trail, a very popular trail hike that you take, but they went off the trail. And they went off the trail almost a mile, and they went down a very steep, rugged area. And keep in mind, this is now dark, and it's dark in the Rocky Mountains. Mm-hmm. And he's at the bottom of this cliff in the middle of the night. He's a mile or two off the trail. You know, he's trying to explain where he is. He tries to start a fire, but there's, you know, the ranger who knows it like the back of his hand really has a hard time finding him, and a lot of the 911 call are going back and forth, and Harold is becoming increasingly irritated that this ranger is not getting there in time. But it's another one of those red flags. They go, why, you know, she's Tony's 50. I can't remember. Harold's about the same age. You know, these aren't kids. Why are they wandering off the trail? So it's another one of those little kind of trouble signs very early on.
Yeah, because as I understand, you know, they go up this trail. It's Deer Mountain. He's got this plan. They're going to stay. Yeah, it's Stanley Hotel.
Yeah.
And yes, a lot of my guests that have to do with the horror world of a genre of writing. You know, they talk about events and things they have once a year at Stanley Hotel. So it's, yeah, very, very popular place. So they're in. So they're there, and then they're going to go out. They have lunch. And then they're going to go on this hike starting sometime around 3-ish o'clock and then have dinner reservations for about 7 at a nice restaurant, which anybody would tell you. Now, most women are not going to want to just barely get back in time to freshen up from a hike to go to a nice restaurant. You know, we want to have time to really look good. You know, we want to look good, and we want our man to be proud of how we look and get all dolled up. And plus, she'd had knee surgeries. I mean, she seemed like more of an active, athletic woman, but she'd had a couple of knee surgeries. And
yeah,
she was active as a young woman.
She played high school basketball, but yeah, she had two knee surgeries. And it's an interesting nuance. The woman, the prosecutor in the case was a woman, and you don't often see that a lead prosecutor is a woman in a federal murder case. But she made that very point. And she said, Tony, God bless her, loved her lipstick, and used that as evidence against Harold, something I can assure you no male prosecutor would have thought of, which is, why would she be out in the middle of the woods? She did her hair that morning. She put on her lipstick. She did not dress for a long, arduous hike. And now it's dark. And so the whole thing was just not making a lot of sense.
Yeah. And another good point, too, with the lipstick and having her hair done, but having the lipstick on, was that it was supposed to be, you know, very pink, like a very fashionable color of pink, a little bright. And and they were saying, you know, if he really did CPR on her, why was her lipstick on, fresh, not messed up, and there was none on him?
Exactly. He should have been covered in lipstick. Often when you do CPR, you break a couple of ribs because you push so hard. That did not seem to be the case. So from the very beginning, it was strange. But like you said, you know, different people react to traumatic events differently, and I don't know how any of us would act. So you have to, you know, suspend that a little bit and give the guy some benefit of the doubt. And they did eventually find him. And it's the middle of the night. And when they did find him, he had started a little fire, and she was dead. She did not survive the fall.
Oh, horrible.
Okay, yeah, wow. Sorry, I got ahead of the story with that lipstick thing because, you know, those dead giveaways. So then she doesn't survive the fall, of course, and that. But what gets people, I mean, there's all the red flags that all the people there are picking up on, the dispatcher, all the people involved that he calls, people involved with the rescue and rescue efforts and the law enforcement there. And after they, you know, get her out of there or get her body out, and somewhere, I don't remember how far it was, but somewhere along the way, someone sends a note to the law enforcement saying, you might want to check into how his first wife died.
Yeah, it was very soon, and it was an anonymous note and letter, and it was actually sent to two or three agencies locally there. You know, the case got a little bit of attention. It actually didn't, it would be a very, very big news story eventually, but at the time, it was kind of just portrayed as a tragic fall. And in fact, that's what all the official news accounts said for about a year. And if you read the news accounts in the very beginning, you know, the local stations happened on a weekend, and the local news station posted a online story saying, oh, you know, this woman died tragically in a fall, and her local newspaper did the same thing. And yet somebody either read that or knew about it personally and sent notes to a couple of law enforcement agencies saying, hey, this is not Harold Henthorne's first wife, and this is not the first time one of his wives died, and it's not the first time they died suspiciously. You may want to take a look.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a very good clue.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if I'm leading you faster or jumping around too much, so let me know what happened to the first wife.
Well, her name was Lynn. And keep in mind, Tony and Harold, they met on a Christian Mingle. It's a Christian dating website. And mm-hmm. Tony is from a very, very prominent family in Mississippi, and they were mortified that she had gone on a dating website. And they didn't, you know, they were happy for her. They thought Harold was a little overbearing and obnoxious, but they were happy for her, and she seemed very happy. And they had a daughter, which was always her dream. And you know, they lived a very good life. And he kind of mentioned in passing, oh, yeah, I had a wife. I'd been married before. Tony had been married before. She was divorced. And Harold said, yeah, I'd been married before, but she died in an accident. And you know, Tony's family, the Bertolets, were nice enough to not press, and they didn't press. And that's all they knew about his first wife. She died, and it sounded like a car accident, the way he described it. But they didn't press, certainly didn't research it. Well, her name was Sandra Lynn. She went by Lynn. And they had been married in the early 80s, lived in the Denver area. And one night in 1995, Harold and his first wife, Lynn, were out driving in the middle of the night in a remote location when Harold reports that the tire of his car, his Jeep, was feeling kind of soft, spongy. It wasn't a blowout, but he thought the car was driving strangely. He pulled over to the side of the road and jacked up the car. And there's a whole bizarre sequence of events here involving jacks that don't work, and he used two different jacks, but eventually he gets the tires, the right front passenger side tire, off. He walks around to the back of the Jeep, which is a hatchback, and he throws the spongy soft tire into the back, and he says the Jeep fell off the jack. And that's when he hears Lynn say, "Harold, help me, Harold," something like that. He walks around back to the front, and the Jeep is on top of her. Somehow she managed to get herself face down on the ground under the wheel well, and she's being crushed by the Jeep. And that's what kills her. Now, you can...
That wasn't suspicious to anybody?
Well, and, you know, the first gentleman asked me about law enforcement, and
yes,
sometimes they do really good work, and sometimes they don't. And this was one of those cases where, and this takes up a lot of my book, they investigated it. It was Douglas County Sheriff, little sheriff's department south of Denver. They sent a young investigator, I think it was only his second death investigation, maybe his first. He had never really been trained as an investigator. He's basically a highway patrolman. And he gets this cockamamie story from Harold about his wife somehow ending up under the Jeep, and maybe she went, you know, shimmying under the car to get lug nuts. He didn't really know. He gave different versions of the story.
Wow.
But after 5 days, they cleared it as an accident.
Wow. Unbelievable. Wow. That's,
and it was a remote area. Yeah, kind of a remote sort of area where there weren't a lot of people going by, a lot of traffic or anything.
Yeah, mountain road. And, you know, you see the similarities. It's the middle of the night.
Yeah.
Nobody around, just the two of them. He's the only witness. And he gets a big insurance payout, $300,000 to $400,000.
Most crimes that, I mean, honestly, when there is no, in my opinion, when you see that there is little or no investigation, it gives people that mindset that they can go and do it again because they got away with it the first time. So I can
hit the nail on the head, and that is what law enforcement said motivated Harold this time. He got away with it once. Why not try it again? The money was running out, and he needed some more. He got away with it very, very easily before. Nobody questioned him very much, and so he decides to try it again.
That was motivation enough. Just think about it. Yeah. Wow.
Do you think he was the kind of person, too, that thought that his plan was so clever that he just outsmarted them, that he thought, you know, he was totally of a superior intellect?
Well, and, you know, he has a master's degree, and he's a trained geologist, so he thinks he's a pretty smart guy. He's a big talker. People always talk about him being a big talker. And, you know, he did not get charged the first time. And the second time, the first investigator, and it's sort of the way the National Park Service, rangers don't just tell you to put out your fires, and rescue people. They're also trained investigators. And Ranger Faraday, the guy who had to trudge out there in the middle of the night and get Harold, showed up at his house a day or two later as the initial investigator. And Harold thought he was, he called him Barney Fife. He thought he was just an idiot. And,
I was thinking Barney Fife. I really
yeah,
was thinking
and he used,
Fife.
Yeah,
Fife.
He used
wow.
that very word. You know, and you can imagine, you know, Ranger on his hat and all that. And he just had no respect for this guy whatsoever. And yeah, that was a theme. What Harold didn't understand is that the Park Service works in cooperation with the FBI, and there aren't a lot of Barney Fife with the FBI, and he met his match.
Good. I think the Barney Fife was the first one. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, yeah, it really was. But he kept calling the other guys with the park, the park ranger Faraday, he kept calling him Barney Fife. Faraday was no Barney Fife.
No, he was a very look, he knew, and you know, not to give away too much, but there was a big clue they found in Harold's car. By the way, another Jeep. He seemed fixated on Jeeps, same kind of car that fell on his first wife. He was driving.
Well,
he sold that and got a new one. It's just it's very cheapy.
Everybody's got something lucky.
Yeah, they did find
everybody's
a big
got
clue.
A lucky talisman. That is yeah. something.
Yeah,
you know, your lucky underwear, your lucky
clue,
Jeep.
Yeah, exactly. But there was a clue, and it was something, and maybe we can leave that one out, and you could read the book and find out. But it was something that also kind of, it wasn't physical evidence, but it was another red flag piece of evidence that that put them
wow,
hot on the case.
This is very intriguing, honestly. It's just amazing the arrogance of that person that he actually, and he tried the exact same thing the exact same way. Again, nothing changed, nothing, even down to the insurance policy. And how long, I'm sorry, I didn't read the book, so I'm just wondering, how long was he married to the wife, that the second wife, the one that he had the daughter?
It was their 12th wedding anniversary, 12 years.
Wow. That is just horrible. Okay. Yeah,
and let me just say right now, this is, I'm sorry, Kenya, since you just mentioned that. Let me just say, too, I'm talking with true crime journalist and author and television personality Michael Fleeman about his newest, I mean, hot off the press book right now, The Black Widower. And if you want to call in and talk with Michael, the number is 646-716-9922. That's 646-716-9922, a toll-free call in the continental U.S., and you can also pick up a copy of Black Widower. I was saying earlier to Michael that, you know, it's your favorite bookseller. But, you know, if you're going to buy it online, a very, very cool place, and I think most book lovers know this, would be Powell's Bookstore in Portland. So you can buy from them online.
Okay.
Wow. So back to the story. So, yeah, Michael, this show is just going by so fast. So, yeah, so he has one. And both of these women just seemed like very, very nice women. You know, just very intelligent, good-hearted, kind, who sort of got into a marriage, you know, on good faith because he put on all his, you know, his best and wooed them and courted them. And not that they were stupid, but they were, they, you know, I think their hearts were willing to believe him because
yeah.
he put himself out
they,
as like,
they,
I'm
they
a Christian man, I work.
Yeah, they had a couple of things in common. Both they kind of looked the same. They're both redheads. They were both very Christian women, very giving, very, very, lived lives of faith and built around church and not just going to church, but giving back and helping people. Lynn, his
yeah.
first wife, was a social worker. Tony was a doctor, you know, very giving women. And two women who always saw the best in everybody, which is, you know, and I'm a cynical journalist, and I admire that in people who can look at people and only see the good. But the flip side of that is I think there's a certain naivete, and they
right.
don't see certain things. Or they see them and they rationalize them. And there were certainly a lot of trouble signs with Harold, especially in the second marriage. But Tony you know, again, insisted on seeing the best. And you know, she had had one divorce. She didn't want to get a second divorce. They now have
right.
a daughter, little girl, 6, 7 years old. And so, you know, she really wanted to make this marriage work. But he played on their faith, which I to me is the most heinous thing on earth. And,
yeah.
you know, he met her on a Christian dating site. And he sort of, you know, if you look at his profile on the dating site, and he talks about being a man of God and all these things. And to say that, not because he believes it, but because he's trying to rope in, you know, sugar mama is really odious. And these are the things that kind of came out afterwards. But the two women, they had very, very similar personalities, very giving, very loving, very forgiving, and yet also, I think, a little naive.
Michael, can I ask you, did you find out from the second family, his second wife, the family, did they interact with the family at all? Were they close enough that she could confide in her family? Or was that one of those situations where you kind of alienate them and conquer, you know, conquer and divide,
yeah.
keep them apart?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I interviewed her parents, both her parents and her brother. And this was a point of contention in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Now, keep in mind, she was in her late 30s when she got married. She was no kid. She was a doctor,
right.
you know, so it's not that they can say too much. This is a very genteel Southern family. They're from Mississippi and speak very, very thick Southern accents and have a very strong sense of propriety and decorum. And they're very reluctant to confront. But certain events happened in the marriage. Certain events happened in the second marriage that got them very, very concerned. Harold would start isolating Tony, which is very classic and abusive. And they would call from Mississippi to Denver, and he would listen in on the phone calls. He controlled all the money. He wouldn't let her talk to her mother one-on-one. And at the same time, Tony was... You know, it was irritating to her parents because she would always seem to sort of take Harold's side and kind of mom butt out was her...
Defending him,
I think more defending her choices. And I think she was defensive
that.
About marriage. You know, it's like you really want to admit you're a two-time, you know, met two loser guys. And so...
Exactly.
You know, and so her mother would pry a little bit. And she, you know, her mother's a nurse and her father's a millionaire oil man, and so they're not shrinking violets, but you know, she was feisty, and she, you know, when she had to be, she would really fight back. And so she was very defensive of this up until the very end. And I think that's probably in addition to the money. You know, they always say the most dangerous time for a woman is when she's about to break up with a man.
Yeah.
And there's certain indications
mm-hmm.
that she may have been about ready to leave him. She started separating their finances and made her very vulnerable. And there was an incident, and we can talk about it, but there was an incident in which it appears he tried to kill her before and failed.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
When the family found out about it. And again, it was written off as an accident. And he got away with it a second time. And finally, the family, you know, the family said enough is enough. But, you know, I interviewed her mother and father, and, you know, these are two very, very strong people, very successful, strong people. And they're both in tears talking to me, saying that they're going to forever feel guilty that they didn't do enough, that they shouldn't have been so kind. They shouldn't have been, you know, so willing to let her have her way. And they, you know, and it's sad and it's heartbreaking. They really blame themselves for not doing more.
That is heartbreaking. I mean, honestly, but you said it earlier, Michael, and I can relate to that part of being in a relationship where you really do even though sometimes it's that thing that I used to say when we were kids, like, I might can fight my sister all day or my brother, but you're not allowed to pick on them. You know, that's that thing in that relationship when people start, because it reflects you. It reflects on you, basically, when you're talking about your mate. When people say, well, oh, my gosh, you're allowing him to do these things to you, or why aren't you doing anything about it? That defense mechanism jumps in, and then you find yourself maybe defending certain actions that don't seem that big unless you know how the story ends. So she did not know how the story would end, in my opinion, and it might have seemed as if it's okay to protect or defend myself because I can handle it. And sometimes we can't handle it. Not even women. I mean, people in general. Sometimes those situations that mm-hmm. we think we can control don't always end up going the way we think that they're going to go because you can't read the other person's mind. So I was just thinking about her parents and thinking how any parent would feel as if they should have seen the signs or they should have known better. That's just any parent. And there's just sometimes you might see the signs of your kid being on drugs, but you don't know when they're doing it. You're not with them all the time. You can try to stop them, but you can't keep them a hostage. So I don't know. It's just I hate that they do feel that way, but I can understand feeling that guilt. I can understand that.
Yeah, and like I think it's probably, too, because she had a daughter. You know, she may have been
yeah,
reluctant
the daughter.
To break
now,
up the family.
Now, I mean, to her parents' credit, they were able to channel that guilt in a very positive way. And one of the things they did is they basically served as deputy investigators. And they very quietly and very methodically built evidence against Harold, acting like they were still supportive, that they're the supportive grandparents and they visit. Meanwhile, everything he said and did, they would take notes and pass it on to the FBI.
Smart.
Secret.
Wow. Smart.
Ah, yeah. That's clever. Let me stop and say this right now, if you don't mind. If you are just tuning in, my guest is Michael Fleeman, true crime writer. Michael Fleeman is an award-winning journalist, best-selling author of, 12 books published by St. Martin's Press. He's also a New York Times bestseller for The Stranger in My Bed and Love You Madly and Seduced by Evil. I think I've read, as I look at the list, I've read all but two of your books, Michael.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm a Fleeman fan. you specialize in covering. He is. Longtime reporter for Associated Press, covering criminal justice and courts, including the L.A. riots, O.J. Simpson trials, Timothy McVeigh, Oklahoma City bombing trial, and your Simpson trial coverage earned a nomination for a Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
Just thought I'd put that in there, Mr. Fleeman. And two, if you ever see, let me tell you, Michael, I see you all the time. You've been, as a public speaker and a commentator, you appear regularly on Entertainment Tonight, E! True Hollywood Story, Inside Edition, HLN Showbiz Tonight, CNN, True TV, Investigation Discovery Channel, Oxygen, and of course you're going to be on the Escape Channel's Deep Undercover soon. HLN, do you know my friend Art Harris?
I've been on shows with him, as a matter of fact, over the years. But this would be like this might have been 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, I met him at a Nancy Grace taping in a show, Swift Justice, in Atlanta years ago. And he's been on... He was on one of my first shows, but I just had to give my Michael Fleeman promo right there, and we're talking about his new book, The Black Widower. Okay, Michael, because I don't want to give it. Also, because I want to tell people more about you, but I also don't want to. I also want to keep us from giving away too much of the story because I want people to buy the book, The Black Widower. So. I think, you know, too, I think the one thing that was Harold Hinthorn's undoing was that with the first wife's accident, yes, he got her in a remote place. It was dark where he had plenty of chance at night. People wouldn't see what happened. But he just happened to really luck out that the people that did come to help, the law enforcement personnel, were not that well trained. You know, I'm not saying they were bad people. They just weren't trained. They just didn't know certain things, and they just, you know, the one of the guy had him in a car road. They just talked to him, but they never actually interviewed him. So a lot of mistakes were made. A lot of evidence was not collected. And so he just got off so well with that. I'm sure he thought he could do it again. But when he caught him with the at the park, when he was at Deer Mountain, he didn't count the fact that he was dealing with federal. This happened on federal property, federal lands. He's going to be dealing with federal agents, and they don't play. And they don't be in a position without really being
trained. They have vast resources. You know, something the Douglas County Sheriff's Department couldn't do in the first case, but the FBI could do, which is hop on a plane and interview a lady in Texas or Mississippi or wherever. And that's what they did. You know, that they could write a subpoena to get his cell phone records, which was very important, to find out what was on his computer, you know, to do these kinds of things. But I do want to stress, and I read this, wrote this book rather, kind of in midstream. The trial had not even started yet. This was not a slam dunk case, because, and we've all, you know, we've been seeing all the OJ stuff lately, and I remember that case with so much physical evidence. There was no physical evidence. There's no video. There are no eyewitnesses. There's no confession. There's nothing, no written statement that, you know, he's proclaiming that he did this. It was a very, very difficult case to build against him, and it was a circumstantial case. Now, they tell jurors that circumstantial evidence has the same weight as direct evidence, but we all know that's not entirely true. And so it took them years to build this case against him. And in the end, and as you read the trial section of this, you're really going to find that it was sort of Harold's personality, his way of reacting, the things he did that played against him. He was his own worst enemy because they didn't have the smoking gun. The biggest thing they had was the first wife's death. And even up to the last minute, his lawyer said, no, don't let that evidence into the trial. That has nothing to do with the second wife. That was investigated, and he was cleared. It's not fair. It's going to be prejudicial to the jury if they hear this stuff. And so it was very important for the prosecution to get in those details from the first wife's death to try to show a pattern, to try to show propensity to do this sort of thing. So it was touch and go. It really was. And even with all the resources and skills of the FBI, not until the very last minute was it clear that they were going to get him.
That's actually very interesting because as you were describing how this actually came about towards the end, I had to remember how you started the story. And as you were talking, I really realized there really wasn't evidence there. There really wasn't anything, as you would say, the smoking gun that would just say, okay, yes, he did it. Just looking guilty does not, I mean, is not a reason enough to, because you don't have a defense against whatever it is that you're being charged for. That is really a hard case when you put it like that, Michael.
It was. Yeah. And what happened was, and I after this, I did a the local drug task force in Denver was nice enough to invite me out, and I spoke to them. And, you know, these were seasoned drug investigators, and they were, you know, their prosecutions depend on fingerprints and, you know, finding drugs on people and stuff. And they said, how on earth were they able to try to build a case? And I said, well, they had to think like a writer. They had to spin a story. They had to tell a story that was so compelling that a jury would be willing to convict.
Wow.
Wow.
Believable. Wow.
And that's brilliant. Yeah. Like a writer, and see what would work, you know, from a writer. Because, you know, I got to tell you, this weekend, my husband and I were changing out the brake pads and rotors on my car. And I'm telling him about this story, you know, and I'm going, okay, so no, I didn't do it, but I said, like, if I were to try to get down, if a lug nut rolled off, because that's what the guy said, Harold said, I told the first wife, oh, why was she under the car in that position? Well, I think a lug nut rolled off and she crawled under the car to get it. Well, you know, I can assure you, you know, I would not be sprawled out in that position. Get it? I would just, if lug nut rolled, you know, because you put them in some place where you'll keep them right beside you, I would just put a stick underneath there or something and just knock it out front of the car. Nobody would do that.
Right.
You know, that's just the thing. Nobody would crawl up.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
You want my personal theory how she got underneath? This is not in the book.
Yes.
My personal theory is that she did crawl under her own power, that Harold was verbally abusive to her and scared and jittery and said, you stupid, you know what, you dropped him, you go get him, you know. Mm. Okay, Harold, okay, anything, you know, to shut him up. And she did it.
Yeah.
And then that's when there's some evidence that you can read about in the book, but there's some very compelling evidence that they totally ignored that proved that, suggested that he kicked the car off the jack. But I think if you put it in the context of an overbearing, verbally abusive man and a woman who just do anything to try to get the peace, to try to settle him down,
mm-hmm.
because one of the big mysteries in the first wife's death is how did she get under there? Because there were no scratches. There were no contusions. He didn't bonk her over the head. He didn't drug her. Okay, so how did she get there? You know,
how did she get someone to go underneath a car? Gotcha.
Yeah, but you've seen couples where the wife is so beaten down and so frazzled and so intent on trying to bring some bit of peace to the relationship that they will literally do anything just to quiet him down and calm him down. It's like, okay, if you want me to crawl under and get these stupid lug nuts, I'll crawl under, just stop yelling, Harold. And I can almost picture that. It's that kind of a relationship. Now, this is me talking. There's no evidence or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, how did she get under there? And I still think she went under there under her own power for whatever reason.
That's about the only way you could get her under there, honestly, because it's not easy to get underneath a car, even when you have it jacked up. I mean, you watch the guys working on the cars. It really does take some maneuvering, especially if you're not on one of those little beds that can roll underneath there. Mm-hmm. So to climb under, and they found her face down, right?
Yes.
Yeah, she crawled under, but that is, and so let me ask you this, and I know time is kind of wrapping up, but this guy is really, he's got my brain kind of ticking. I'm just thinking, what type of guy was he before he married his first? Was he a loner? Was there signs that, you know, he had mental issues before? Was he working off of greed? Was he just a cruel human being before her? What was his life before?
You know, I didn't see, you know, there were no obvious signs in his early life, you know, an abusive father or anything like that. No obvious mental illness. The theme that everyone talks about over and over again is that he's just this big, big, big talker. He's a guy who knows everything about everything. And is loud and obnoxious. A lot of people called him a used car salesman.
Wow.
And he was very, you know, in the pejorative sense, and very overbearing and very overpowering. And he had to have a woman who was, you know, and I interviewed a lady he dated in between these two wives, and she just thought he was, oh my God, all he'd talk about himself, and, you know, it just wouldn't be quiet. And either you're completely turned off by that kind of a big personality, or, you know, if you need, I don't know, you know, I both of these women seem to be attracted to it, but super overpowering, overbearing, had to just be, you know, he sat in on Tony's meetings. She was an ophthalmologist at her eye clinic, and he was like a husband.
Oh,
he sat in on
right.
the financial meeting.
Wow.
You know, so it's that sort of thing that just, and by the time they had the kid, you know, he had to make every single decision about every single little thing that ever went on. He also, by the way, planned both of the weddings. He picked out all the music. He picked out, you know, everything that was going to. He had to decide how everything was going to go. Even though Tony's parents are paying for the darn wedding, he made all the decisions. He told them what was going to happen. He didn't pay a dime, and yet he had to be in charge. This kind of big, arrogant talker.
So he set the tone of what the relationship was going to be like from that day forward. And of course, as you said, you know, opposites attract. In this case, in these cases, they went against – but sometimes people find that attractive, that aggressiveness, that go out and handle things. But something about this just tells me, though, as much as these women were, this guy is as obnoxious as he sounds, there was something that made them fall in love with him as well. So he might have been a different guy behind closed doors in the beginning when he was dating, that wooing part, and they were just trying to get him back to that part. Or maybe they
read the book and you'll see his dating profile, and he really sounds like a catch, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Although when you read
him,
it now, he sounds like an arrogant jerk. But, you know, look, he likes long walks on the beach, and he likes going boating, and
right.
you know, he'll take charge, and he'll protect you, and he'll do nothing but fun stuff, and they'll go to Hawaii, and they'll go camping, and they'll go hiking, and they'll, you know, do all these things. He's everybody's friend. He gets along. You know, he'll talk to anybody. He's great at parties, you know. He's smart, you know, and he's a good church going Christian, you know, and you read this and you're like, oh, wow, he's, you know, too good to be true.
But
and he'd be the first
narcissist.
One to agree that he was too good to be true. You know, he had a very big ego.
Right. That's a narcissist all day long, though. That really is. That's their MO. Everything is about them, and they pull you into that. You know, you just watch people with that personality. It's almost obnoxious but mesmerizing at the same time.
Yeah, in Hollywood we call them celebrities.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. There you go.
Well, listen, and yeah, you can read. You know, Michael's got his profile that Harold did on a Christian Mingle dating site. It's like, oh wait, what? So, oh yeah, he put on a show. He brought them into the web. Michael, thank you so much again. Grateful to have Michael Fleeman. Michael, you know, I talked about having rock stars on the show, but you're such a rock star in your genre, and I'm just so grateful to have you back on here again. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Don't forget to get The Black Widower, and you know, the website's michaelfleeman.com. If you look on all of my social media for Madam Perry, Instagram, or, you know, last time you were on, Michael, I was talking to you about getting with the program on your social media, but and I think you've done better. So, but I'll share with you all of Michael's social media and his website, and also we'll get a link to buy The Black Widower on Powell's bookstore's website, so I can make that just easy for everybody just to click on it and buy. This book will not disappoint. You will be. We just gave you just a little bit. There are so many deep layers and trails in this book that you will just be mesmerized. And look for him on Deep Undercover on the new Escape Network. And of course, like I said, anytime I see you on TV every week somewhere, Michael. But thank you so much. As tomorrow night, Michael, if you're around, I just got word during the show that tomorrow night my guest will be Lita Ford. She is the queen of metal. She was the first female guitar shredder. You know who she is?
She really is a rock star.
Yeah. And
really
she with the Runaways, and she's back on tour. You know, she took off about 10 years or so while she was raising her children, and now she's back on the gig, back on tour. And, in fact, her publicist tried to get her in tonight, but I said, no, this is Michael Fleeman night. I can't move Michael for anybody. But she messaged back in while we were talking that the little beep was her publicist saying, okay, how about tomorrow night? So tomorrow night, Lita Ford, Runaways, the Lita Ford band, queen of metal, shredder, she will be my guest on Madame Perry Salon tomorrow night. So Michael, feel free to call back in, and I will have, as I said, all the links to all your social media and where to buy The Black Widower and all your books on all of my social media. And any parting words, Michael?
No, but thank you. This is my favorite show. Yeah. Pleasure.
All right, thank you so much, Michael Freeman, and my being in the